You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Andre whaa oso tōku ingoa. No mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for ARPA Wednesday, everybody. I'm your host, Andre, and I'll be with you for the next hour. Joining me in the studio is producer Arno. On the show for today, we have our monthly catch-up with the Auckland University Students Association. Today, we're speaking with Engagement Vice President for Lao Tuinu Kuawhi. I speak to Ian Gordon from PSA about Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown's council budget and PSA's statement saying that Brown's budget proposal is holding public services hostage. On the Green Desk, Jack Marshall speaks to Amanda Thomas, lecturer in environmental studies at the University of Wellington, about stopping oil and gas exploration in Aotearoa. And Alex speaks to Simon Oddie from Eke Panuku and Matt Wheeler from Beka about the proposal for a digital twin of Auckland. Arno, who do you speak with today?
I speak with epidemiologist Professor Michael Baker to provide a COVID-19 update.
Thank you for that, Arno. E aha, he aha o whakaaro. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these stories. So get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai. Text in on 53595. Or why might Arne give us a call in studio on 09 309 3879. Kawa e ware ware e a hei ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero, kōrero anō he pākihere. Roki roki mārungo i te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho. Mea haere ki 95BFM ira katikom. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Wire. Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
I'm joined in the studio this afternoon by AUSA Engagement Vice President Folau Tuinu Kuawhi. How are you, Folau?
Good, feeling good. How are you?
I'm doing good. It's a bit chilly in the studio today, but yeah. Warm overall, though. So semester one exams are currently underway in the University of Auckland. 3 years since the COVID-19 pandemic began. How have exams and how's it changed?
It's definitely a big switch from online exams to in-person exams, which I'm sure all of our students are kind of trying to sort out how to study for these kind of exams. But there are resources everywhere with AUSA and the university to help our students get on board with studying and doing these exams.
Since online exams have become more common, there have been concerns about high numbers of students cheating. Technologies like ChatGPT have also become a concern for universities. Has this been a problem at the University of Auckland?
Yes, ChatGPT is one of our increasing cases for, I guess, the disciplinary committee. After talking to our education VP, Varsha, and our advocacy manager, Blake, they've based their advices to realise that ChatGPT is not 100% accurate. And so for students that are partaking in ChatGPT, it's easy to call out or to acknowledge that this yep. information is yep. not like relevant. So it's not recommended to partake in ChatGPT and only use it if it's required by your course or lecturers.
So in order to uphold academic integrity within students and fulfilling their assignments and requirements for exams and stuff, where should they go in order to uphold their academic integrity during exams?
The library support services have really good resources to help students with academic integrity, and also us AUSA, like our advocacy manager, can really help our students uphold these academic integrity practices.
As a student yourself, what message do you have for students during this time, especially those who are sitting their first university exams,
yeah.
us first years?
I definitely want to say study hard, but also really prioritise your mental well-being these times. Like at the end of the day, university is a little part of our big life, so definitely study hard and go hard, but prioritize your mental well-being and stay safe, and yeah.
Once, thank you for that. Once our exams are over, AUSA will be putting on Rio Week. What can you share about your plans for this?
We don't have finalised plans yet. However, it's brewing and we've definitely got free goodies running for that week. And it'll be super similar to last year's O Week for those who were here. But just keep an eye on our socials for more details about that.
Looking forward to that. Quick shift as well. As students, we've all faced issues with the cost of living crisis. And right now it is difficult for many people to attend university because of that. Heading into election year, what support would you like to see for students?
We would definitely like to see cheaper rates for public transport, 100%, which is one of the campaigns that AUSA is jumping on with, you know, VUSA and a bunch of other universities. So definitely free or at least subsidised pricing for public transport. And yeah, like there are a bunch of campaigns that we're actually jumping on for the general elections if everyone just stays up to date with our socials. They'll see what we're supporting in terms of combating the cost of living in this crisis right now.
In terms of any real, you know, immediate support that students might need, how can AUSA help students?
We have hardship grants at AUSA for anyone, and we offer them semester one and semester two. You can apply for them as many times as you want, and there's not much of a list to tick off per se, like for if you need money immediately. So definitely reach out to AUSA for that. And the university itself also has their own hardship grants as well.
So where do they immediately go if they need that support?
Come to our house, AUSA House on Alfred Street, or access our website and you can just fill out a form super quick and get that access.
Perfect. Thank you so much for that. That was AUSA Engagement Vice President Folau Tuinukoafe. Thanks for joining me in the studio today.
Thank you so much.
But in terms of comparing it to the current prison system, though, would you say that it could be an improvement?
I mean, no, you have to improve a piece of shit.
The Wire.
Michael Baker, University of Otago professor and epidemiologist, joins us today from Oslo, Norway, to talk about the latest updates on COVID in New Zealand, following an article published in the New Zealand Herald on Sunday. Although New Zealand has done comparatively well in managing the health crisis, hospital admissions are still high and a number of people are expected to die from COVID this year. I started our interview by asking Michael if people still needed to be worried by COVID.
Well, I think we should be concerned about it, but in a constructive way, because obviously we've moved from that phase when we didn't know much about it, and I think it was quite terrifying for a while at the beginning. And now we know a lot about it, and so I think we need to be to use that knowledge really constructively to minimise the harm that it's causing to us.
COVID accounted for about 6.3% of total deaths in 2022. Is this number expected to rise or fall?
Well, I think it's definitely falling this year. So it looks like we're going to see maybe 1,000 deaths this year from COVID-19 based on the year-to-date, if we project that out. So it's definitely our number one infectious disease killer now. But it's certainly moved down the list compared with the other causes of death in New Zealand.
Who is COVID most likely to affect?
Well, it can infect people of all ages, but those that have poor outcomes, in other words, get really sick, go to hospital and unfortunately die sometimes, is very much older people and also people with underlying health conditions. And that hasn't changed throughout the pandemic. So the big difference now is that people have immunity to the virus to varying degrees based on vaccination and having had the infection and having protective antibodies and other parts of the immune system that protect you. So that's the positive news. We are adapting to having this virus circulate. The not so good news is that it's still a major cause of illness. And at the current rates, we would expect perhaps 14,000 hospitalizations this year. So that's a really big impact on our health system that none of us want, because that's preventing other people going in for other procedures. So that's not good news. The other area that we're still very concerned about is the long-term effects of this infection. At the moment, we don't know how many people have these effects, how long they last, how severe they are. And it's partly because this is still a new virus that we're still trying to understand. But at the moment, you have organisations like the World Health Organization saying 10%, maybe more, of people who survive the infection do have long-term effects. But some studies are saying it's fewer, some are saying it's more. But this is certainly a virus that can affect many parts of your body, the lining of your blood vessels, how your brain works, your general level of energy and fatigue, how your lungs work. This is a multi-organ disease, and we're still learning about it.
The World Health Organization has said that COVID-19 is no longer an emergency pandemic. Do you agree with this statement?
Oh, absolutely. It doesn't need an emergency response anymore. They have a particular term they use, and that's a pandemic or public health emergency of international concern. And that means that it needs some regulation. It may affect travel and trade and so on. And so it's to try and coordinate the global response. So we've moved away from it being or needing a disaster response. It's still a pandemic by definition. It's still affecting multiple countries. It's still causing new waves of infection. It's still unpredictable. So for that reason, it's still technically a pandemic. But at some point in the next, perhaps this year or next year, we'll start to get more confidence that it's a relatively predictable threat, more on par with influenza. And at that point, we'd say it's effectively endemic. So in other words, it's there all the time to varying degrees.
I read that Maori and Pacifica people are more likely to be affected by COVID. Why is this?
Well, there's multiple reasons. One is that Maori and Pacifica are less well served by our health system and society in general. We still got the effects of racism in our system and discrimination. I think that's something that we should be very concerned about and we need to keep working on. The other related consequences of that is that Maori and Pacifica and middle age have a higher prevalence of long-term conditions that make them more vulnerable. And also they have lower vaccination rates. They're underserved by the health system. So some of these are long-term problems that we really have to get to grips with. Some hopefully we can fix more quickly, more rapidly, particularly access to vaccine.
So it sounds like we need to get more people vaccinated overall. Is this correct?
Well, I think now it would be very much focused on older age groups and those who are more vulnerable. And I'm still surprised that, if we look at even the second booster, not even the third booster or what we call the fifth dose, but what we call really the fourth dose, it's a bit confusing. Even then, only a little over 50% of people who are eligible have actually had that fourth dose. And let alone getting their fifth dose, which everyone over 30 is eligible for. So I'm still really surprised that people are not taking advantage of this free vaccine because it is still life-saving for people. It will reduce your chance of serious illness. And it does seem to offer some protection against long COVID. So I think that's really important. It's not such an issue for younger people. Young people should still have had their primary course and hopefully their third dose. But certainly there are older New Zealanders who are missing out on this.
Now that it's winter, is there another wave of COVID infections expected to occur?
Well, yes, we would say that that's possible. I mean, certainly winter, people spend more time indoors. There's certainly the time when other respiratory infections transmit much more effectively. Some we virtually only see in winter, things like RSV and many others, and flu obviously peaks in winter. But the thing that's interesting about COVID-19, it hasn't got a seasonality yet. I mean, we saw our biggest ever Omicron wave in February last year in the height of summer. So that's because it's a new infection and we don't have immunity to it. And that's why it's able to spread at any time of the year. But over the next few years, we might see COVID-19 settle into the same pattern of other respiratory infections. It certainly hasn't done that yet. But at the moment, we've just coming out of what looks like we're coming out of our fourth wave. And this wave is much smaller than the three we had last year. So that's good news that it does appear to be settling into a more stable pattern. But the thing that I'm finding still quite concerning is we're not seeing the baseline rates drop to a really low level. We're still seeing something like 300 people a week going into hospital. And that's, you know, quite a large number of seriously ill people. So I would really like to see those numbers come down. One of the remarkable things is that, and this is about New Zealand's overall response, we're the only country of any significant size that still has no excess mortality and or cumulative excess mortality in the 3.5 years or so that we've had the pandemic.
Yeah, so are you basically saying that the people that died in New Zealand of COVID might have died anyway, or that other people could have died and therefore our overall mortality rate has not increased?
Yes, well, New Zealand is the only country of any size that has had no excess mortality cumulatively since the beginning of the pandemic. So that's over the last 3.5 years since January 2020. So if you look at a country like the US, they've had about 0.3% of their population has died over and above what they would have expected. That's driven by the pandemic. And that represents about 1.2 million people who've died from this infection. And it's pushed down life expectancy there by about 3 years. So it's a massive effect on public health. New Zealand has avoided that entirely. And the reason is that we've kept our COVID-19 mortality very low, but we've also, or the measures we use, have also lowered mortality from other respiratory viruses. So that means we're sitting on zero excess mortality at this point, which is really an amazing achievement.
What should people be doing to minimize their risk now?
Well, I think apart from or in addition to vaccination, the main thing is that if you have respiratory illness, and initially you won't know what it is, it's just self-isolate. Assume it could be COVID-19, it might be influenza, it might be one of the other respiratory viruses. But I think we need to have a new culture in New Zealand that you don't go off to work or school or social events and ignore your illness and infect the other people around you. And I think that it's been very good that New Zealand's kept the self-isolation approach for COVID-19, and effectively it's covering other respiratory infections, because you might have to wait a few days to do your COVID test to see if you're positive, maybe at day 3 or day 5 of your illness. So I think that's a really important cultural shift we've had. The other big change that I think is hopefully getting more established is thinking more about the indoor environments that we share with other people, and that's thinking about ventilation in particular. And there's still one situation in particular where people should think about masks, and that's in poorly ventilated, crowded places. And the most, or probably the worst place, is still public transport, unfortunately. And if you think about busy commuter buses, where people might spend hours in that environment every week, and the ventilation is very poor. And we know this because we do CO2 monitoring in a range of environments, and buses, unfortunately, have very high levels of CO2, which means you're rebreathing air from other people. And so, and if you look at, say, if you visit Asian countries that are used to managing the things like SARS and then COVID-19, people wearing masks, it's just part of the culture there now. And I think we need to look at that in New Zealand, perhaps in particular over winter.
That was Michael Baker giving an update on the COVID pandemic.
The government has indicated
The Wire.
Auckland Council Urban Regeneration Agency, Eke Panuku, and Becca, Koitu, the Centre for Informed Futures, the New Zealand Infrastructure Commission, Te Waihanga, and Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei are making the case for a digital twin pilot in Auckland city centre. I spoke to Simon Oddie of Eke Panuku and Matt Wheeler of Becca about the opportunities and risks of digital twins. First, I asked Simon Oddie what a digital twin is.
a digital replica of our city, or in this instance, our city centre. It can be an interactive 3D model, bringing together things like the city's buildings, its infrastructure, modelling its different systems. I suppose from my perspective, the important thing is that they aren't static models, so they can also be used to represent real-time data, and so you can see how your city is evolving and how it's faring in real time, and sort of track trends. They can also be used to simulate the future of the city centre and engage people in that future, and they can be really useful tools in helping us to make evidence-based decisions as well by bringing all that data together.
What does a digital twin mean for the commercial sector?
We're really interested in helping to achieve productivity gains. There's a lot of people who are planning to invest, particularly in physical asset infrastructure, who don't necessarily know what other people around them are doing. And so if we can create a digital twin that helps share information about what others are doing, then it will inevitably reduce or minimise rework or people trying to do things that aren't complementary.
So there's efficiency gains in there?
Yes, absolutely. And proven by the investment in digital twin in Britain, for every £1 spent on a digital twin, it resulted in at least £5 of overall productivity gains.
What are the risks of having a digital twin?
I think the bigger risk is probably not having one, in terms of how far behind we are falling within other major cities. We are a growing global city, and that's a position that we actually need to fill. Security is probably the biggest one from a lot of people's perspectives, and I think there's good systems that can manage that nowadays. And I think it's one of the challenges that we probably have to grapple with is the ownership of data and how, you know, different intellectual property rights sort of manifest within what we'd hope is a relatively open digital model.
So what's it like to interface with a digital twin? Is it lots of maps, or is it like the metaverse or video game?
So we're really excited to gamify a digital twin and provide a platform and access for people to get in, learn a bit about the history of the place, what it means to Mother Senua and stories from before colonisation.
There are about 250 different cultural groups, I think, living in the city. And I think a huge amount of immigrants come through the city centre on their way. And would there be any opportunity to tell all of those broader stories?
Yeah, of course. And I think one of the really valuable aspects of this is we can make it so that people can add their own stories into the digital twin, so it can be a tool to capture those stories as well.
Provide feedback on what people like and why.
Of what already exists or what is proposed to change?
What's proposed to change? So what we're interested in is providing a lens into potential future Auckland scenarios. So if you imagine RTS Square as it is today, a number of public and private sector parties are planning different types of future investment, whether it's the Kākanā Reiha RTS Studios, home for performing arts practice, or potentially a new metro centre or the new CRL station. What that might look and feel like when it's finished, along with activation of spaces. So not just modelling physical interventions, but also bringing places to life through activity so that people can get a holistic view of different potential future options.
Who would be able to propose options? I know that Chloe Swarbrick, for one, has been pushing for a school in Artia Square. So how many different proposals could there be for what goes into a place?
Oh, unlimited, which is why it's quite exciting. I think that the opportunity for anyone to participate and propose different future solutions and to provide feedback on those is welcomed. The platform and the game, if you like, will only become stronger with more people participating and more optionality for the future. And we want to try and help provide a way to show these and for people to help understand what the impact of those investments might be. For example, investing in building a city centre school will have positive effects in terms of education, access outcomes for the city centre and master plan, and the Auckland City Council master plan, and we want our digital twin to be able to help show what benefits and sometimes drawbacks of these investments might be.
So the user could have a bit of a play, could they, to consider different impacts of changing weather systems or what it would be like to have a big public library underneath a school, underneath a residential tower. You could sort of get a sense of how that would change the dynamics of a place?
Yeah, that's right. We really like the idea, and it's been done before successfully. The Financial Times produced the sustainability game early last year online, and you can assume a persona in the game and make decisions through one of these personas. So our vision could be something like SimCity meets Minecraft meets Pokemon Go, where you could participate and compete, if you like, using limited resources such as money, obviously, but also see the cost, for example, in carbon of what investments you're looking to make as well. So it could be a game that you go in and play many times. We really want people to participate multiple times as things change, and also have a bit of fun with your friends and your fun out.
Thinking of the anniversary floods, could you model rain on that level and see how it impacts the city and the housing stock?
There's a lot of work that has to go on to make that possible, obviously, but yes, it is definitely within the realms of possibility to be able to.
Could you put avatars in? So if, say, temperatures reached a certain point and there was very little shade, you could see how the sort of the impacts of changing weather would impact on people's well-being?
Yeah, well, I definitely think we could be modelling things like where the shade is in the city centre. You know, you'd be able to model the policy statement for urban development impact on the city centre and see what that does in terms of creating shade and the likes as well. And then you could effectively model people and how they would be interacting with the city centre sort of at that people level. That's often the aspect that we miss really easy for us when we're planning cities, to look at sort of top-down and 2D maps and think that we're doing a good job, but we're often missing that sort of people element on the street. What does it mean? And one of the benefits of the digital twin is that we can actually sort of model the on-the-street experience.
That was Simon Oddie of Ekipanuku and Matt Wheeler of Becker talking about a digital twin for Auckland.
You're listening to The Wire on 95 BFM. We will be back after this short ad and song break.
What's a seven-letter word for street fighter?
Brawler.
Hey, you're right. Okay, what about treasure trunks and six?
Chests.
They said you were good. Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Well, tonight there's
Botico Beats with Juliana Sion, Timothy Nolia and guests.
And tomorrow,
Comedy Night with Corey Gonzalez-McCure and friends.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Oh, it's freezing.
Why do you only have a t-shirt on?
I'm not really a sleeves guy.
What?
Well, the truth is, I'm just not as confident when I cover up my sweet tattoos.
Here, take my BFM hoodie. It's just as cool as tattoos.
95BFM merch is now at the University of Auckland campus store. 95BFM hats, hoodies, t-shirts, totes and more. B-merch.
Grab your B-card and bring it in for a sweet discount.
B-merch. Get yours now from the campus store. B-merch. Or online at 95bfm.com/merch. BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
You're listening to The Wire on 95 BFM. Love to hear your thoughts on any of the stories that have been on so far, so please get in touch. Tuku Pātuhi Mai, text in on 5395, or Wire Maidane, give us a call in studio on 09309 3879. It's now time for my favourite part of the show, The Green Desk with Jack Marshall.
This is The Green Desk on 95 BFM.
I'm an oil man. Ladies and gentlemen, I have numerous concerns spread across this state. I have many wells flowing at many thousand barrels per day. I like to think of myself as an oil man. As an oil man, I hope that you'll forgive just good old-fashioned plain speaking.
And that was, of course, Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood, a fantastic film about the oil industry in America. But this week, we're coming closer to home in New Zealand. In 2018, the New Zealand government decided there would be no new offshore oil exploration permits ever again in New Zealand. The ban was hailed by Greenpeace and conservationists worldwide. At the time, the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, said her government has plans to transition towards a carbon-neutral future. But the ban remains fragile, says a group of academics. Recently, the New Zealand government granted an offshore oil and gas permit because the application was lodged before the ban was put in place and granted afterwards. The matter went before the High Court, and the High Court ruled that was okay. Today on The Green Desk, I'm speaking with Amanda Thomas, a lecturer in environmental studies at the University of Wellington. She is one of the three authors of Stopping Oil, Climate Justice and Hope. Here's my conversation with Dr. Thomas. Explain a little bit about this book, why you were involved in writing it, and what you found in the book.
Yeah. So there's three of us that have written the book together, Sophie, Bond, Graydon Ditbrose and I, and it's based on research that we did mostly from 2013 through to 2017, talking with and working with some of the community groups that were opposing offshore oil exploration and extraction. And so we interviewed a bunch of community activists. We also talked to people from the oil and gas industry, some iwi representatives and some people working in regional and local governments to kind of find out how the space was changing and how people were resisting extraction and the response of oil and gas companies to that. The reason we wanted to put it into one place, into a book, was that we wanted to capture the successes and the struggles and the stories of these activists, because I think we often have a really short memory about that sort of stuff, and so it makes it really hard to kind of learn and grow and sustain momentum sometimes. So, for example, we have a chapter in there about activists' experience of the police and being policed, and for lots of the Pākehā activists we spoke to, when they experienced violence from the police, and this was reasonably common, they were really shocked because that was their first experience of being policed in that way. We know that Māori are seven times more likely to experience violence from the police than Pākehā through the use of batons or dogs. And so one of the things that we wanted to do was capture that kind of story and place it within the context of colonialism, so that hopefully some activists might read that and go into situations where they might encounter the police with a little more preparation in some ways. So they know that the police can be violent and it's very hard to get accountability for that. But also if they're Pākehā, they're much less likely to experience violence than people of colour around them. So what does that mean for how we do activism, for example?
Mm-hmm. Would you be able to give a little bit of the history of the oil and gas industry in New Zealand and kind of give us a perspective on how big it is? Because, I don't know, it's kind of one of those things that it's offshore, it's done under the ground, and it's kind of, you don't really think about it.
Yeah, so when the block offer process was ended in 2018, that was sort of after a decade of investment and growth, and the national government really encouraging and fostering close ties with that industry. So by 2018, there was something like 22 active permits for exploration, and that was held by big companies like Shell and OMV, and they had permits to explore for fossil fuels in an area the size of the North Island, but in the sea environment. So a huge amount of our territorial waters carved up and made available to these companies for exploration. But of course, the fossil fuel industry has a much longer history in Aotearoa New Zealand. So in the 1930s, petroleum was nationalised. And so that has been the source of Waitangi Tribunal claims to say that Māori were alienated from that taonga and from that development opportunity, and the Waitangi Tribunal agreed that that was a breach of Te Tiriti when that nationalisation happened and all the processes did Māori from that resource, and whether or not Māori would have developed it in the same way is kind of irrelevant. It's about the opportunity and that process of colonisation more broadly. We sort of saw a much more of a ramping up of fossil fuels through the 60s and 70s in Aotearoa New Zealand. It's never been a huge, huge industry, but like I say, big investment in it, particularly in Taranaki in recent decades. The language at the time was that we needed to make the most of the resources in our hills and in the seas to catch up with the development of Australia. You know, this narrative we hear over and over again, that we should be catching up with Australia. So it was bringing in something like, the industry says that it was bringing in something like $650 million in royalties. So there are and were a lot of people in Taranaki working in that industry, but it's only ever been quite a minor player in our economy overall.
But more and more cars are going electric these days. Do we really need to worry about the oil and gas industry? Here's Dr. Thomas.
I think we should still be worried about it. Christopher Luxon said last year if National was elected, then they would bring back the block offer process. And it was interesting because he said in one of the interviews, he basically used exactly the same language that the fossil fuel industry uses about the need for gas, that gas is an important transition fuel. So it's cleaner than coal, they argue, and so we should be exploring and exploiting gas much more. Now we know globally something like 89% of all carbon emissions comes from fossil fuels, and that in the next decade we need to halve our use of fossil fuels to have anything like a kind of livable world. So we need to be really worried about the fossil fuel industry and the close ties that they have managed to foster in the past with politicians, for example, here. So we need to be really mindful of the same kind of narratives being repeated and questioning the kind of truth to them and the actual need for fossil fuels when we have a whole lot of technology at our fingertips already. We have so many alternatives already available to us.
Do you have any kind of personal things that you see as the best transition tools? Not so much the degrowth or less consumption, but in terms of like solar or hydro, or is there anything that's kind of captures your imagination more than others?
I think rather than thinking about in exactly those terms of what is the best technology, sometimes it's more useful to think about the scale. So locating energy production within communities. So there's places like Blueskin Bay, just north of Dunedin, where they have worked for ages to try and develop their own wind production and their own wind turbine. So localising production close to consumption can kind of be a more useful approach, whether that's solar, whether that's wind. It's something that we should be thinking about a lot more.
Thank you so much to Dr. Amanda Thomas for talking to me about the history of the oil industry in New Zealand, where we're heading in the future, where we could be heading in the future,
and about the book Stopping Oil.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Order.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
The Auckland Council budget is holding public services hostage. That was what PSA had to say about Mayor Brown's Auckland Council budget proposal. On the chopping board in Brown's budget is the selling of Auckland Council's stake in Auckland Airport, which has been a consistent revenue stream for the council since Auckland's district councils merged into the super city in 2010. Tomorrow, council members will vote on Mayor Brown's budget proposal, including whether to sell off Auckland Council's airport shares. To talk more about what implications the share sell-off could have for public services in Auckland, I spoke with Ian Gordon, PSA National Sector Leader for Local Government. In the lead-up to the Auckland Council vote tomorrow, what are the sentiments towards the budget proposal?
Well, I think there is quite a great deal of concern, I suppose, and apprehension on what's coming. You know, I mean, generally speaking, you know, our members are really concerned about, you know, the potential cuts both to services and also jobs. And, you know, it's obviously a pretty complicated scenario, but, you know, generally speaking, I think it is, you know, just this kind of political football that feels like it's going on at the moment. And, you know, using public services as a bit of a bargaining chip, Mayor Brown seems to be doing, you know, is not particularly nice from a membership perspective.
Well, speaking on that, Mayor Brown has proposed cuts to public services if the Auckland Airport share sell-off doesn't go ahead. Isn't this position on cutting vital services as that bargaining chip, as you said, quite problematic?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think that the problem that, you know, the proposal that the mayor and the council have been consulting on is, yeah, it sees significant reductions in a wide range of services. And that sort of, you know, some of those, for example, you know, there's holding public transport. So not, you know, not increasing or reinstating, for example, the bus trips that have come about since about December 2022, you know, because of driver shortages. I mean, and there's also impacts on, you know, price increases and service reductions around, say, the zoo, the art gallery, stadiums, you know, all the public venues, and a whole lot of reduction or stopping of regional services, you know, and that include community and education programs, you know, for citizens' advice bureaus. I know that's been in the media, but, you know, things like Proud Centres, Pacific Arts, Māori initiatives, and all of the different little, you know, sort of regional events that Auckland often hosts, like Music in the Park, Culture Fest, you know, Movies in the Park, and all those sort of events that actually make Auckland attractive to visit. So it actually has quite a big, you know, economic impact as well in terms of, you know, promoting Auckland as a livable city. And so we're really concerned that you know, because that also sitting alongside that, you know, council staff supporting all that stuff and all of those roles will be impacted to some degree or other. There's also, you know, for example, 44 community gardens that are under funding threat, you know, Marae development programs, youth, rainbow, new migrant initiatives, you know, so there's it's a really big area of cuts that are being discussed at the moment, and also withdrawal of childhood education services and also climate action related funding. So yeah, it's a really massive set of cuts that are being proposed.
What would be the long term loss if the sell-off of Auckland Airport shares goes ahead? Would that just basically mean that all these cuts would go ahead? What risks would that have for Auckland's future and the future of Aucklanders?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the thing with the airport shares is that it's almost akin to selling off the goose that lays the golden egg. So, you know, like, these shares were gifted through and, you know, came through from Manukau City Council into the Auckland Council when it became the super city about 12 years ago. You know, obviously, if you're selling off shares to investors, essentially, then the ongoing dividends and income that you would have is you know, I mean, you lose that on an ongoing basis. So while you might make the initial money now for on the sale. I mean, obviously that means that in the long term you don't have those assets to, or the income from those assets to help you in the future. And I think, you know, the other thing is that we're essentially selling off that golden goose now. Can't sell it again, and you know, in say 10 years time if we ever have another, you know, financial situation like we do now. So once they've gone forever. Yeah, and I think that's a bit of a problem. And I think, you know, in terms of, it's just, you know, I think it is quite a big issue for the wider Auckland community to consider.
What is the alternative to selling off airport shares whilst maintaining public services and filling the budget deficit?
Yeah, I think in terms of alternative, it is really about, you know, because, I mean, there is the ability for Auckland Council to take on debt. I mean, sure, there's a debt level at the moment, but actually, you know, debt is something that can spread out costs over a period of time, and council can actually, you know, raise debt, and those interest costs, I think, they have, because of the size of the organisation, they can take it on at a generally lower interest rate, for example. So it sort of spreads it out, and it's much more fairer way of spreading costs across the community rather than perhaps getting, for example, individuals to pay for services that they might otherwise have to pay for. So rather than sort of racking it, you know, every time you want to do something around Auckland and you have to pay a fee or increase costs, I mean, you know, spreading that across the community through rates and through debt is another option. You know, we're aware that there is a budget alternative that's been put up by another organisation, a better budget for Auckland. So they've kind of got some really useful options that they put forward, which, you know, possibly makes sense.
That was Ian Gordon, spokesperson and PSA National Sector Leader for Local Government, speaking to me about the implications that the Auckland Airport share sell-off could have for Auckland.
That was The Wire.
Koera te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Whālao Tuino Kuawhi, Engagement Vice President of the Auckland University Students Association, Michael Baker, University of Otago Professor and Epidemiologist, Simon Oddie of Eke Panuku, and Matt Wheeler of Becker about a digital twin for Auckland. And also thanks to Ian Gordon, spokesperson and PSA National Sector Leader for Local Government, speaking to me about the implications of the Auckland Airport share sell-off. And also thanks to Arno and Alex for joining me in the studio today and producing those great pieces. And also big thanks to Jack Marshall for the Green Desk. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. We'll see you same time, same place next week. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Bridge.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.